From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Steely Dan was huge in the 70s and just about one of a kind. Frontman Donald Fagen says that sound had some very specific inspirations. Eminent hipsters, he calls them. He's out with a sort of memoir that takes us way back to his hipster heroes and right up to date to touring at 60-plus, reeling in his years.
Your everlasting summer, you can see it fading fast. So you grab a piece of something that you think is gonna last. Well, you wouldn't even know a diamond if you held it in your hand. The things you think are precious, I can't understand. Are you reeling in the years?
This hour on Point, Steely Dan's Donald Fagen and his eminent hipsters. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. What did you hear, do you hear, in Steely Dan, in Donald Fagen's pantheon of hipster inspiration? His tales from the road. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Or join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from Philadelphia is Donald Fagen, co-founder with Walter Becker of Steely Dan, Rock and Roll Hall of Fame inductee, multiple Grammy Award-winning musician, songwriter, and he's an essayist. Steely Dan has sold more than 40 million albums worldwide. Donald Fagen has had his own substantial solo career. He's out with a kind of memoir, an artobiography, he calls it, titled Eminent Hipsters. Donald Fagen, welcome to On Point. Great to have you.
Hi there, Tom.
You've been writing a lot for a long time, and it's really fun to read. And then at the end of this sort of memoir, sort of collection of your essays, you turn to a journal of your time on the road, what, a year or two ago, and you just had me in stitches. I mean, I always wondered what people were thinking on stage after they'd been touring for many years, but you're up there, and it is really a bleak stream of consciousness you've got going from the stage, Donald.
Well, I hope you got a few laughs out of it.
Absolutely. GQ calls you one of the most consistently sardonic voices in rock, but you're up on stage imagining, you know, sort of daydreaming about the whole theater going up in flames in a flash fire and the audience screaming up the aisles and trampling each other. You write, I guess I'm getting more and more thin-skinned as the tour goes on. What is it like to be up there at 64, 65?
Well, yeah, the point of that passage, and in fact that whole tour diary, was the fact that I think it happens to a lot of people when they're on tour, is they develop a mood disorder that's directly connected to the stress of touring. It sets in after about 3 weeks, and that's really what that's about.
And no easier when you're, I guess it was 64 when you were, the tour that you were journaling on here.
Yeah. Well, now I'm 65.
Okay. Compare and contrast doing that at, I don't know, 35 and 64, 65.
Mm-hmm. Well, we toured when I was in my 20s in the 70s, and then we quit in 1974
right.
for
mm-hmm.
various reasons. Mm-hmm. But now it's actually a lot easier than when I was in my 20s, because the touring conditions are better, the transportation's better, the sound is better, so it's not quite as bad. But when you're out for 3 weeks with the same bunch of people and you're just exposed to, high decibel amplification every night, and the stress of performing, it's kind of you develop symptoms, really. And in fact, at the end of the chapter, I wrote up a little medical description of acute tour disorder, ATD,
yeah,
which I could try to explain what happens.
It's pretty funny. You're out in this time period with Boz Scaggs and Michael McDonald. Of course, he was with Steely Dan and then Doobie Brothers. Mm-hmm. And you are so irascible. You write the thing is lately when I tour with Steely Dan, the venues also seem to be shrinking. This was touring with the Dukes of September. You called that threesome.
Right, right.
You said, mm-hmm. Of course I'm being disingenuous. Mike, Boz, and I are pretty old now, and so is most of our audience. Tonight, though, the crowd, you write, looked so geriatric, I was tempted to start calling out bingo numbers.
Yeah.
Nevertheless, by the end of the set, they were all on their feet, albeit shakily, rocking out to Mike's performance of Buddy Miles, Them Changes. So this, now, is what I do, you write, assisted living. Oh, man. I've never heard anybody write
actually,
that.
That's true, although, you know, it's kind of a privilege to be able to get people up and dancing and all that kind of stuff. You know, these are people. In a way, I'm making fun of myself also because, you know, I'm up on stage. I'm the same age they are. And
sure.
It's fun to see how much they enjoy the show.
Would you begin to take us back to some of what you call your eminent hipsters? Not eminent Victorians in your case, but
mm-hmm.
eminent hipsters. What, you're a kid of the 40s, born in 46, I think.
48, actually.
48, excuse me. Mm-hmm. And you write in here about that coming of age in the late 50s and the early 60s, and the music and the media that was feeding you as kind of an outlier kid who had his own take on the world, and what was feeding your young ear and mind at that time. Where did you find your eminent hipster inspiration?
Well, you know, I was kind of lucky. I had an older cousin who was a jazz fan. So she kind of hit me to jazz when I was pretty young, 9 or 10 years old. Mm-hmm. She had a great LP collection. And so I really, I just took to it really easily. And I lived in New Jersey, but we were able to receive the late night jazz shows that were on at that time, broadcasting from Manhattan. So I, you know, would, you know, take the radio under the covers so my parents wouldn't hear and listen to these jazz shows. And I just really became a big jazz fan.
We've got one of those here. A big hero, early hero of yours was Gene Shepherd, the DJ, broadcast on WOR AM out of New York City.
Mm-hmm. Gene was not a musician, but rather he would just talk. He was a monologist on WOR, and he had a fantastic world view and style, and He had a lot of fans who were a lot of kids at the time, and he had, in fact his show was syndicated, so it wasn't just East Coast.
Famous for the Christmas Story reading, telling.
Yeah, most people might know him as a narrator of the film Christmas Story, which was based on one of the stories he used to tell on the radio about growing up in Indiana.
But he had these monologues. I guess the music connection is that they were almost jazz-like themselves. And I've got a little tape here, Donald Fagen. This is February 1961, one of Donald Fagen of Steely Dan's eminent hipsters, Gene Shepherd, 1961, giving listeners, maybe you were listening, Donald, Gene Shepherd's thoughts on modesty.
Now, if you will please, I will be prepared to tell you something about our industry, our world, our life, and our time. Yes, modesty is a virtue. You don't think for one minute that any actor, any star, anybody who ever really makes it is modest, do you? Let me tell you, you ought to hear Olivier talk about Olivier. modesty is a virtue, but it never got you a fat contract. Ever.
Gene Shepherd, WOR, 1961. I doubt you were still under the covers at that point, but what were you listening for as a kid in New Jersey with a little bit of a different angle on life, Donald?
Well, I don't know. There was. I think Gene Shepherd was, you know, one of those people who were really one of these marginal artists. I think Mad Magazine was another. It was a way of looking at society that was not what you were fed every day on the news and on TV and so on. That was it gave you a lot of perspective, you know, and which was amazing since, you know, for a young person, you know.
Was Steely Dan ultimately, you were at Bard College when you clicked in there, was it an expression of that kind of alt view, hipster view, your hipster view of the world?
Well, my partner and I had similar childhoods. We were both jazz fans. And, you know, I think the fact that both of us turned to jazz when we were pretty young was a kind of there was a kind of desire to look for some kind of authenticity in American life. And we both turned, like a lot of American youth, to, you know, an alternate culture to find something that seemed more real, you know. And in our case, it was black music, you know, John Coltrane, Miles Davis. It just seemed like it had more depth than anything in white bread American culture.
And not to mention a little science fiction. Donald Fagen writes in his new book, mm-hmm. Eminent Hipsters.
Well, yeah, actually, the thing about science fiction is that a lot of it was really satire. They used the future worlds in order to, look at the contemporary world.
It's an interesting lineup of eminent hipsters that Donald Fagen cites. We'll look at more of it. Henry Mancini, the Boswell sisters, Connie Boswell, and much more. Joins us from Philadelphia. Listeners, you can join us as well. What did you think you heard in Steely Dan? Did you hear a kid inspired by Henry Mancini, sci-fi, overnight DJs, Connie Boswell and her singing sisters? Did you hear a love of Ray Charles, Earl Hines, Ike Turner, Charles Mingus? We're at 800-423-8255. 800-423-TALK with Donald Fagen of Steely Dan. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Here's their East St. Louis Toodaloo. This is On Point. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with Steely Dan frontman Donald Fagen about his eminent hipsters and the cultural outliers that shaped his sound. Steely Dan and beyond. Here he is, solo, single, 1982, the Nightfly, Grammy-nominated album of the same name. The song was an ode to the late-night radio DJs and Donald Fagen's life as a lonely high schooler, as he writes. He's got a new book out called Eminent Hipsters. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. And you can join us this hour. What did you think back in the day when you listened to Steely Dan? Did you picture a kid inspired by Henry Mancini and sci-fi and Earl Hines and Charlie Mingus? How do we find the inspirations of our youth? We're at 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Donald Fagen joins us from Philadelphia. You might enjoy Donald. I mean, people are still finding their eminent hipsters. Amber writes us on Twitter. I know you're not so much for all this social media stuff, but hey, it pours in. She says, discovered Donald Fagen Nightfly at age 10, zealot of all Steely Dan. Hope my 9-year-old could play Gold Teeth one day. You may be an eminent hipster for some, Donald. Right there. Yeah, it's cute. We got it from all over the world here. Fernando says, do you know how the Steely Dan music has a huge reception in Latin America? Italo writes, greatest band ever. Can you please tour Australia again? Apart from that, asks, who's your greatest influence apart from Duke Ellington? People picking up on your theme. I don't know if you can rank them, Donald, but...
Yeah, it's kind of tough, but, yeah. I like... You know, jazz from the 50s and 60s was probably my main, my main thing in the when I was a kid. But I also, started looking into the history of jazz. So I like, a lot of the swing bands, especially the black swing bands, Erskine Hawkins and, stuff, Chick Webb and all that. And then I went back even to the beginning of recording, back to the 20s with Duke Ellington and so on.
We just talked about Duke Ellington this week. Interesting to hear your inspiration there. But you go even further back, or at least more obscurely back. I've got a track here that you write a lot about in Eminent Hipsters, to the Boswell sisters, Connie Boswell in particular. But here's a track called early inspiration to Donald Fagen of Steely Dan, the Boswell sisters with We Just Couldn't Say Goodbye, 1932.
I went right back and kissed him, and when I looked around, the room was singing love songs and dancing up and down. Now we are so happy because at last we found we couldn't say goodbye.
People in love are funny, mighty hard to explain. 1 minute they quarrel.
Connie Boswell there and her sisters. You know, I guess I can kind of hear some threat to Steely Dan there, but what were you hearing? And what are you thinking now when you call her, include her in your pantheon of eminent hipsters, Don?
Well, she was, first of all, just a fantastic singer. You know, these were three sisters from New Orleans, three white girls, but who were influenced by all the jazz that was happening in the jazz age in the 20s and early 30s. You know, they started out as classical musicians. And then, you know, Connie, who used to play the cello, switched to saxophone. This was back in the 30s, you know. And they had, and Connie was a genius. She would do these arrangements where with a lot of tempo changes, all kinds of vocal tricks, and they were just really creative.
Going way, way back, and then not quite as far back, another track that you cite here, and it's interesting again to kind of hear how this may flow towards Steely Dan and your solo work. Earl Hines, Roy Eldridge, 1965, at the Village Vanguard, where Donald Fagen used to hang. Here they are live with Blue Moon. You write that you were down there young with your cousin, New Jersey kid, in the city at the Village Vanguard.
Mm-hmm.
What was your frame of mind coming in and listening to Earl Hines? What a great.
Well, that was, you know, it was unreal to see someone who's, you know, this incredible legend of jazz. You know, he had on this gold lamé jacket and all these rings and so on. And, you know, it was like you know, going back on a time machine to the 20s or something like that. It was just great, and he was fantastic.
Before you know, we've got Steely Dan coming on. Just with all that history behind us, here they are, Pretzel Logic, 1974, Steely Dan.
Yes, I'm gonna be a star and make them laugh. Sound just like a record on a phono. Those days are gone forever, over a long time ago. Oh yeah.
Donald Fagen with his partner Walter Becker there, 1974, Pretzel Logic. Donald Fagen is with us from Philadelphia. Got a new book out called Eminent Hipsters. Donald, lots of callers for you. Drew in Cleveland, Ohio. You're on the air with Donald Fagen.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi. I wanted to ask Mr. Fagen about... back in the 70s, you did a lot of songs about people kind of like living on the fringe, the kind of people who weren't quite legit. And I'm thinking particularly about a song called Everyone's Gone to the Movies. I wanted to know how did your record labels react to these, to the subject matter that you put forth in these songs?
We were on the ABC Dunhill label, and they in those days, you know, it was the days of FM radio, and the DJs had a lot of DJs. They didn't have any supervisor. They could make up their own playlist, so we didn't have trouble with that. But the label gave us total freedom. We never had one problem with their trying to oversee us or edit us or anything like that. We were totally free to do whatever we wanted to.
How did they? I mean, these days everybody gets tracked, right? You're this or you're that or you're that. Steely Dan was this sort of amalgam of all kinds of things. Did they say, we don't know how to categorize you, or did that not matter in 1974?
Well, you know, some of the critics, you know, would wonder about that, but we never wondered about it. It wasn't really jazz. We loved rhythm and blues, so it certainly had a rhythm and blues bass, but we used a lot of jazz harmony, and, you know, the lyrics were funny, generally speaking, and I don't know. We never really thought about it ourselves.
Joel writes to us, Donald, on Facebook, says, asking you, did you want to be the band that only BAs in English understand?
No.
Do you know what he's talking about?
We were so happy to be making a living playing music that's really all that mattered to us.
But you certainly took it off in your own direction. I mean, reading in your book, there was a time when that's how you pictured yourself, maybe teaching English. It's not like that was far from your circle of interest.
Well, no, both Walter and I used to read a lot. And we, when I went to school, I actually hadn't decided to be a musician yet. I had an amateur jazz trio in high school, but... I thought I'd end up in journalism or teaching English or something like that. And then I finally switched to the music department for a while and decided that maybe I'd try music.
Worked out all right. I want to get another one of your eminent hipsters in our listeners' ears here. And this one kind of surprised me. Maybe I came along too late for this to be seen as hip, but It was working with you. This Henry Mancini, one in your lineup, and among the things you cite are his music from the TV show way back when called Peter Gunn. Here's a track, Dreamsville, Henry Mancini and his orchestra, 1958. This was played in the TV crime drama Peter Gunn. Help us, Donald Fagen, because for people who came along later, this could sound like Muzak, but there you were in the 50s, and it was saying something to you that popped you out of the mainstream. What was going on in your reaction?
Well, it's kind of like the first sort of cool jazz I ever heard. Although I actually had heard some more authentic jazz that my cousin used to play me, and I realized it was kind of once removed from jazz, really. He was a commercial writer using the tools of jazz to accompany a TV show. But there was something very cool about the way he evoked atmosphere, and I really appreciated that. And you know, he was, a lot of people, their first discovery of jazz was through Henry Mancini.
I mean, you write in your book that even in the time that you were headed off to college...
Also, I liked Muzak.
Okay. Why?
Because it amuses me.
Does that mean it's good music, or...?
Not necessarily. It's kind of like... in the 50s, there was this kind of new leisure class, and basically what you were being told was that, the hydrogen bomb, there may be a nuclear war any day, the hydrogen bomb is very powerful. It was obvious the government didn't know how to handle it. But you're basically told, go shopping. Amuse yourself, play golf, and listen to this music. And there was something that just I thought was hilarious about that.
It's true. It really can be mind-bending.
Just like when they tell you to, in case of a nuclear war, hide under your school desk.
When you put it that way, we absolutely get it. There's Henry Mancini behind us. You can hear some of that influence maybe in Donald Fagen's own He did his own soundtracks. One of them was the instrumental piece Blue Lou for the 1992 Glengarry Glen Ross. Here's a bit from the opening, Donald Fagen's Blue Lou. James in Boston is calling. James, you're on the air with Donald Fagen.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Yeah, I have a comment and a question. My first comment is, I'm a university student now, and when I was younger, I hated Steely Dan when my mom would play it for me. But I started to listen to it more and more, and I heard it in all this rap music that I loved that I was trying to rebel against my parents with. And now I love Steely Dan. And I think that this is a way that a lot of young people get introduced to the band. So it's not necessarily assisted living music. So do you have a favorite sample from hip-hop that has used your music?
Donald Fagen?
I like some of the, especially some of the early usage. There was, Tribe Called Quest. It was the one that used a Peg sample.
Got another listener, Pat, asking along that line about Kanye West's Champion, samples Kid Charlemagne in particular.
Yeah, that was kind of strange because I thought it was a little repetitive, really. But in fact, when Kanye asked us about, he sent us his people sent us a sample because they need a license. And at first we said no, because neither of us particularly liked the piece, really.
Okay.
But then he sent us a handwritten letter that was kind of very moving. He said the song was, about his father and so on. And so we said, yeah, okay.
And off it went. What do you think, James, to hear Donald commenting on his sampling in the hip-hop world?
That's good to hear. I mean, my favorite one is the same one, Peg from De La Soul. It's not Tribe Called
That's
Quest.
That's it, yeah, De La Soul. Also, there was Ice Cube did a pretty funny tune using green earrings.
Hey, James, roll with that. Let's bring in some more influences here. It's great to hear from you, James. Ray Charles, another big one for Donald Fagen. Here he is, of course, the famous Georgia on My Mind. We'll hear an echo in some Donald Fagen work here in a second. First, Ray.
Georgia, Georgia, the whole day through, just an old sweet song keeps Georgia on my mind.
The great Ray Charles. We're going to hear some of Steely Dan's My Old School in a second here, Donald. Can we hear Connective Tissue?
I don't know about Connective Tissue between that. My Old School is more of a rock tune, but you could just play it.
I mean, you are pretty great with words. You're a great writer in this book. I mean, we know the lyrics, but get some good essays here, and you're very kind to Ray Charles.
I love Ray Charles. Yeah, he's probably the greatest singer, pop singer of the 20th century for sure.
Would you have thought about his phrasing when you started singing?
Well, yeah, I mean, this Ray was on the radio when I was a kid. He was probably one of the first black crossover artists after Nat King Cole, and definitely the first one where you heard actual gospel phrasing and a gospel feeling, and so it was just a revelation, really.
We're talking with Donald Fagen of Steely Dan about some of the eminent hipsters. Title of his new book that he found as a youth that influenced him, Ray Charles, and many more. Donald Fagen, please stand by in Philadelphia. Lots of callers for you. We'll go to them right after a short break. Listeners, you can join us. How do we choose, find the inspirations of our youth? What did you hear in Steely Dan? 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK, My Old School, 1973. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with Steely Dan, co-founder Donald Fagen, rock and roll Hall of Fame inductee, multiple Grammy Award-winning musician, songwriter. He's out with this kind of a memoir collection of his essays and journal from the road. It's called Eminent Hipsters, and he writes a lot about his early inspirations. Behind us right here, his own work from very recently, 2012, Weather in My Head from the album Sunken Condos, hailed as one of the best 50 songs of 2012 by Rolling Stone. Just a couple years ago, he's very much still at it, touring, sometimes not happy on the road these days. He writes hilariously, kind of grumpy old man style about that, but he's still reeling them in. Here on Facebook, Donald Kevin writes, "Hey Donald, not all your fans are old. My wife and I are in our 20s. We saw you guys this summer at Red Rocks in the rain. Amazing show. It's still going on." And
fantastic. The more young people, the better. It's like, I'm glad that that young people can get into the music, you know.
You like nerds. Maybe we're a little bit of one, champion them. Nerds got all kinds of place right now. Status right now, here's Ted. He calls himself a keyboard nerd, and he's got a keyboard nerd question for you. He says, where did you first hear a Rhodes through a phaser? You're going to have to help me here, Donald. Perhaps Silent Way or Bitches Brew, or did you happen upon it in the studio? Explain and reply, if you would, Donald.
Well, that's a technical question, but it's a good question. I don't really know.
What is a Rhodes through a phaser, if you'd be so kind?
Well, what it is the phaser is, a Rhodes is a Fender Rhodes piano, which is, one of the sort of the main electric piano that was popular in the 70s. It was the first electric piano was a Wurlitzer piano, which was a little more of a primitive instrument, but mm-hmm. Rhodes had a really sleek sound. A phaser is a device through which it kind of it evens out the sound, and it gives it a kind of a swirly sound to it that makes it sound a little organ-like. And I guess this mm-hmm. kid likes that. But, I don't remember really the first time I heard that. But I know the first time I heard an electric piano was hearing Ray Charles play it on his famous tune, That's All Right.
Yeah. And there you were taken. I mean, you write when you first thought.
Or it's actually What I Say.
What I Say. You were noodling around on the keyboard and you thought you weren't good enough to have a band, but then you listened and they went in the late 60s, early 70s and thought, oh, I can do as well as a lot of what you were
doing.
Well,
by jazz standards, I didn't have quite the kind of technique that professional jazz players had, but I was kind of a jazz snob. I didn't really much like rock and roll in high school, but a couple of years later, I realized, when I started to really like the Rolling Stones and the Beatles and the Birds and stuff like that, I realized that, I had, more than enough technique to play that stuff.
Let's get more callers together with you. Stillwater, Oklahoma. William, you're on the air with Donald Fagen. Thanks for calling, William.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I really like Steely Dan. I'm kind of raised on radio, and I got to see them recently and got to wear the Steely Dan T-shirt.
Woohoo!
Great, because Steely Dan T-shirt, it's a really... it's a statement,
So, I have a
I don't know what it's
too,
a statement of. Yeah. I don't know what.
Why Steely Dan? What do you like about it, William?
It was really cerebral. I mean, kind of subversive, really. I mean, because they had the beat and also the story. I mean, the pretzel logic and some of the Donald solo work IGY. I mean, you kind of saw the story in the song.
Mm-hmm. So, why do you think it's subversive?
Well, I mean, because there's kind of like the, I mean, more or less the, you have the, it's kind of like the, I guess the counterculture, the seeds back then, and there's the, And of course, there's the reality we deal with now. And of course, the leaders that say, well, you know, this is what is going on, but you kind of see the what's really going on beneath that. You know, it's kind of
okay. Well, that I think that's a good explanation. I think it's true that we kind of sneak in a lot of stuff under a kind of a pop veneer. I think that's true.
A little subversion, a little literary illusion. You got oleanders growing outside her door. William, thank you for your call from Oklahoma. Brenda in Wellesley, Massachusetts. Brenda, you're on with Donald.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Donald.
Hi.
First thing I wanted to just say is that Steely Dan's responsible for my husband and I getting married, and that's the truth.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah, and so now we're bringing up our two boys who are 5 and 7 to really know all of Steely Dan, and then if we're in the car playing, you can be sure that they're in the back seat singing. So I just had a question for you about Skunk Baxter, because he was on, I think, all of the recordings, right, until Pretzel Logic, I believe, and then
the
he wasn't
couple.
On there anymore.
First couple,
and,
yeah.
And, you know, he's such a notable guitar player, and, you know, and we've always liked, you know, the recordings that he was on, and I wondered why after Pretzel Logic we didn't see him anymore.
Well, what happened was we were touring for 3 years, 72 through 74, and then when we stopped touring, you know, we didn't have any that much work for the band, because you know, recording, you know, we had Walter and I would take time to write, which would take a long time, and then he only had to come in certain days to play, and these guys wanted work, so he found other work. It was as simple. We had to let him go, and he and Jim Hodder, the drummer, and Denny Diaz, you know, had to find other means.
And so they went. It's not a straight line thing.
Well, yeah, Jeff ended up joining the Doobie Brothers, as well as Mike McDonald, who is our our backup singer and second keyboard player.
Everybody moves around. Brenda, I appreciate your call. I want to look at another one of these inspirations for you, and it's kind of surprising because after his relationship with Tina Turner, a lot of people look at Ike Turner and say, ah, no, but you go way back thinking about Ike Turner, and one of the songs you describe as an inspiration, I'm Blue, the Gong Gong song. This was the Ikettes, 1962, with Ike Turner in their production booth. Let's listen. Ikettes, 1962. How did you figure out that the man behind the music would be inspiring to you, Donald?
Well, you know, Ike was a great producer, and he was a real idea man. You know, I think part of the idea of the piece I wrote about Ike Turner was since he was born in Clarksville, you know, there's the legend of going down to the railroad tracks making a deal with the devil so you could be a great player. Well, Ike was a good player, but he was never a great player, so I figured what he really did was make a deal with the devil and ended up with Tina.
That's the deal with the devil. Pretty good deal for him.
Yeah, it was a good deal. I think it's worth it. Really,
Clarksville, of course, it. Muddy Waters raised there, John Lee Hooker, Sam Cooke, and of course Ike Turner too. I mean, so where do you take that as an artist? What you admire about him is the way he orchestrated things.
Yeah, he was a great arranger, and it was mainly his you know, he had these really original ideas and a fantastic groove. Like he understood rhythm and. The possibilities of rhythm, and it wasn't just the idea of a song. He thought in terms of a record, you know, and how that record would be received.
And so Ike Turner makes the list of eminent hipsters. For Donald Fagen of Steely Dan, Clement in Ottawa, Canada. Clement, thanks for calling. You're on.
Hi, Tom. Hi. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. Mr. Fagen, I won't tell you how much of a fan I am other than to say that I used to sing Pearl of the Quarter and Midnight Cruiser to my son as lullabies.
Ah, that's so nice.
Given the sometimes dark and perhaps seamy themes of some of the songs, did you ever feel there were any sweet ironies in how you could go into a Walmart a few years ago and hear your wonderful songs, entertaining people that might have no idea what they had as distinct meanings?
Well, as I was saying, I like music. I think it's funny, and I think it's particularly funny that you know, they use our stuff as music, and that there's a there's a select number of people who will realize we sneaked in some stuff that people can never imagine into the lyrics. So it's very amusing.
What was it like for you when Steely Dan's music became just utterly pervasive? I mean, Henry Mancini saw this happen with his, to the point it was everywhere, and your college mm-hmm. mates, some of them would, you know, mock it or roll their eyes. I mean, Steely Dan just became such a staple of then AM radio for a long time that...
You know, I have to say, I wasn't that aware of it, because I didn't listen to the radio that much, and, you know, I knew we were selling a lot of records, and but... You know, we were just working on the next thing. It wasn't that much of a conscious thing with us. I didn't really know. You know, I figured, you know, if we were doing well, we probably wouldn't be doing very well for long. And so we were just working on the material, you know.
The Telegraph, Bernadette McNulty, has been a longtime listener of yours, has read the new book, Eminent Hipsters. A couple things she wrote I found amusing. She said when she first heard Steely Dan, the sound baffled her. She said, with its closeted atmosphere, noodly jazz structure, slightly reedy elliptical lyrics, it sounded like the Eagles reimagined by Woody Allen. What do you say about that, sir?
Maybe some of the early stuff might have reminded her of the Eagles. I think, actually, in truth, I think some of the early stuff was more... more influenced by the Byrds, who both Walter and I liked, who were kind of precursors to the Eagles.
Yeah, sure. She also says, she talks about you as a proud snark in your youth, and reading Eminent Hipster, she says, you've matured into a rabidly grumpy old man. This from your journal entries, where you're out on the road, and yeah, you're sort of strung out on road weariness, and there's plenty of grumpiness in there. I mean, you go just broad axe after a couple of generations of Americans here. You call them TV babies. And you say, I mean people who were born after, say, 1960. That's a lot of people, Donald Fagen. When television truly became the robot caretaker of American children and therefore the principal architect of their souls.
Now, what do you think?
What do I think? Do I think everybody born after 1960...
Not everybody, but, you know, I'm just talking in general.
Well, I didn't grow up with television, so I don't have direct experience of
it. Well, there you go. That's why you work for NPR.
maybe. I don't know. You're brave, man. You're brave. TV babies, everybody after 1960, good luck.
Not everybody.
Okay. But a couple generations with television as the principal architects of their souls, I think it's definitely worth thinking about. And there's no question there's an element of robot caretaker.
What do you think when you get in a car and, like, everyone, like, is staring at their palm, looking at their phone, and not relating to each other?
Well, I was really curious in that because you are scathing about all of that online social media and the rest.
Well, it's a very important question.
It's a profoundly important question. Mm-hmm. And yet, up out of that, I mean, you're a huge fan. You write about Wes Anderson, Moonrise Kingdom, and much more, and how much you love him. But then that's interesting, too, because he's sort of a nostalgist of your childhood era, isn't he?
Yeah, that's the weird thing about Wes Anderson is he seems fascinated with my childhood.
And you love him for it.
Yeah, but he's so young. He's he doesn't, you know, he wasn't alive during my childhood. What's up with that?
You describe it like our culture's gone over some kind of continental divide. You're not too happy with it. And yet, here's people listening to Steely Dan. We're hearing from them today, much younger and really loving it.
Yeah, I think it's great, but it's a minority. I think it's you know, what you see, and I do think it's really terrific that people still listen to us. But you know, then you have this this sort of you know, massive number of people who are, you know, watching these reality shows and staring at their palms.
Are you just indulging your curmudgeonly rumination, or do you think it's all going to hell in a handcart?
Hell in a handcart.
Final word, Donald Fagen of Steely Dan. his semi-memoir out this week, wonderful writer, is Eminent Hipsters. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Donald Fagen, for all that music over all that time, thank you very much, sir.
All right, thank you.
Great to have you with us. We'll go out with Do It Again, Steely Dan, 1972, off Can't Buy a Thrill. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.